Fourth one.
Here we are.
Fourth one. Again, still, fourth we're still in the mountains.
We're plugging away. We're doing it. We're getting it done. I think we've properly recommitted ourselves.
I think we're back in the habit.
Yes.
As Whoopi does.
Yeah.
You know, this with nuns, it's all comes back to that.
That's
so
right. I swear to God, no, we're never going to, no more nuns.
I know. There was no nuns in this one that I could see, that I saw.
Anyone who comes into the podcast at this point is going to be like, what the fuck are these guys
talking about? Why is it nuns? Like, well, it is.
It's baffling.
It is what it is. Yes. But we're talking about sneakers.
Oh, boy. Yes.
We watched this as a family, six of us.
We did. This was a family viewing.
With all the joys of family viewing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
And we, but we watched the movie. It was, if you haven't seen Sneakers, I highly recommend this movie.
Highly. This is a phenomenal movie.
Just to give you guys, I'm going to let Matt explain the movie, but just to give you, this was made in 91, 92, right? Mm-hmm. 92. And the cast is spectacular. I mean, we've got Robert Redford, we've got Sidney Poitier, we've got Dan Aykroyd, we've got River Phoenix, we've got Ben Kingsley.
Sir Ben Kingsley
is in this movie.
Sir Ben is.
We've got, I forget the woman.
Mary McDonald.
Mary McDonald is in it, and then McDonald.
David Strathairn.
Yes, David Strathairn, which I don't think...
Not a household name.
People don't know his name, but they know him.
Yes.
He was the dad in River Wild.
River Wild,
with
yes.
Meryl Streep.
He played Edward R. Murrow in Good Night and Good Luck.
Okay, he was also in one of the Jason Bourne films. He was bad guys. I think the second Jason Bourne film.
Yeah,
he was the CIA... operative or whatever that was trying to catch Jason Bourne. So, been in a lot of movies, but the cast was just amazing. And I think as we get into this, what we'll find is because of such a strong acting cast, you're able to get away. You do so much.
This is I feel like I'm actually kind of glad we chose to do this movie, particularly because we're coming off Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. Because this is literally. The exact opposite. Everything that movie got wrong in terms of casting and in terms of concept execution, this movie does perfectly.
Yes.
It's perfectly.
So, Matt, give a recap, though.
Okay.
What is Sneakers,
so
the movie?
So, essentially, Sneakers is about a group of, a motley crew of guys who are sort of, I guess... They all have special skills of the kind of extra legal variety that deal with they're kind of, it's hard to describe what they are.
I don't know what they are either.
They're not criminals.
They're private investigators. Well, their job, they've
ostensibly all had brushes with the law.
Ostensibly, the movie starts with this group breaking into a bank, you think that they're thieves,
yes.
But then you quickly realize that the bank has hired them to test their security.
Right.
So they're kind of all ex kind of.
Yeah, there's Sidney Poitier's character is an ex CIA agent. Dan Aykroyd is the tech guy who They've all had brushes with the law and kind of have checkered past, basically.
Yes.
But they all are kind of brilliant in their own ways in terms of surveillance and technology and breaking into places. And so, yeah, so they basically get hired by corporations and companies to break into their buildings to test their security, essentially. And that's how they kind of make a living how they eke out a living, kind of. And they're led by Robert Redford's character, Martin Bishop, who was actually, in the beginning of the film, we meet him as a young man in 1969, and him and his friend, Cosmo, are hacking into the computer system to basically steal money from the Republican Party, or they find Richard Nixon's private bank account and are transferring funds to the Black Panther Party and the Committee to Legalize Marijuana and everything. And But then the police show up and Cosmo is arrested, but Bishop gets away. So Redford has basically been on the run ever since. So he's a wanted man who's kind of found a way to make a living under an alias now. And he ends up getting approached by these two guys who claim to be NSA agents who want him and his team to help them retrieve this black box, which is this kind of, which is the MacGuffin of the film.
It is the MacGuffin, yeah.
The black box is the MacGuffin of the film. And it ends up being this insane code breaker that can essentially get past any code and break into any system imaginable. And needless to say, they become concerned about that falling into the wrong hands, and it ends up, you know, creating a lot of trouble for our heroes.
And that's
the basic premise.
That's the basic, and so you're watching them try to get this black box, and then ultimately deal with the black box. But you know, I just got to say, this movie, what is this movie like genre wise? Mm. Like, we're watching this, and at some points you think it's a comedy almost because the humor is so. I don't think so. I think this movie was designed as a thriller action movie, but I feel like the comedic elements, they just had so many good comedic or actors who could pull off the timing of the jokes.
Right.
That small jokes that would have been throwaway jokes or just kind of little tiny bits of humor, yeah, are sold and done so well that they become very, very funny. And yeah, and as a result, the movie has this kind of, I don't know, it's a pacing that's kind of odd.
It's a very fleet-footed movie.
Yeah.
It's like a caper movie, I think, is probably the best way to describe it.
Right.
Which is like, essentially like what Ocean, it's like Ocean's 11. It's very much a precursor,
yes,
to an Ocean's 11 type film. But
yes,
I have to say, even though I love the Ocean's 11 movies. I really,
I think they're great.
I think they're super fun and
but
super enjoyable.
Yes.
But they're built on their star power.
Yes.
They are very much so built on the fact that it's a bunch of mega stars.
Right.
And they're great and they're fun to watch and I love those movies. But the great thing about Sneakers is that this is an original movie. It's not based on anything. It's not based on a book. It's not based on another film. It's an original script with original characters. And yet I feel like I want to see an entire franchise.
Oh my God, do I ever want to? Yes.
It's such a shame that they didn't get to do that.
They should have done a Sneakers 2.
This movie, I agree, like the casting is so pitch perfect in this movie. It's absurd. Like, and this movie is a perfect example of if you cast the right actors. I can imagine they probably just were able to cut reams of dialogue because when you have the right actors, you don't have to say as
it
much.
You can see it. Yeah.
They can convey it with a single look.
Right.
And that's the thing I loved about this movie. And I do think the writing is brilliant.
I think
it's a really good screenplay. And even though a lot of the jokes are pretty simple, they're very clever. It's very economical.
Yes,
this movie. That's the number one thing I noticed right from the get go. The way the characters are introduced, and how instantly we know exactly who each one of them is from how they are introduced and what they are said, what is being said, but also who's cast. I think Dan Aykroyd is basically just playing himself in this movie. Like, honestly, I feel like, because in real life, Dan Aykroyd is very much into conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
And like, and his character is very, you know, he's always talking about, you know, how the CIA killed Kennedy, how the, you know, there's, you know, aliens exist, how freaking, what's it called? The CIA caused the Managua earthquake and everything. So that just feels absolutely perfect. Sidney Poitier is kind of the seasoned guy who's trying to keep everybody together, you know, and you got River Phoenix as kind of the young kid who's a little brash and kind of takes chances when he shouldn't. But the dynamic feels so natural.
Right.
And unforced.
Right.
Because, and there's no, and this is a thing that
it's just a fun movie.
It is very fun, but there are no shoehorned in subplots with the characters, which is something that happens now. And it's one of the things, it drives me fucking crazy about movies now, is people, especially, I feel like a lot of this is like, because it's like people my age who are making movies now, a lot of them are our age, and I think a lot of them just they all took screenwriting classes and they all read screenwriting books that said, oh, well, you have to have a certain amount of drama or in order for the story to be interesting. And they overdo it to the point where it's just like it becomes so artificial,
right?
And shoehorned in that it's so annoying. This is such a great movie because they don't do any of that. They know exactly who the characters are, yeah. And they let them be the characters that they are, and they let them
right.
They let them just interact with each other in an organic way, and they don't really get in the way of that.
And you don't need all this backstory. Plot. You don't need yeah. to add all this extra context behind their characters because the characters are so what they are.
Yeah.
And I think that's great.
Yeah.
I think that's fantastic. I'm with you. I don't think you need that. I mean, but you know, getting back to what I was trying to say was, and I think you're right, caper and economical, but like the reason why I struggled with it in terms of genre, like where to put it, the opening sequence where they're breaking into the bank, River Phoenix jumps over the bank teller counter.
That's Robert Redford.
No, River Phoenix jumps over, and then Robert Redford tries to do it again, him, and just falls, like in a pratfall.
Yeah, it's
just a classic. Yeah. You know,
yes.
and you just start laughing out loud,
yeah.
and they go, oh, I'm getting too old for this type of work, type of thing. That's just a comedic laugh. They didn't need to do that right then.
Yeah.
So it's like there's a lot of that where it's like, what is it? I almost feel like the movie, I almost feel like the director and the actors had a lot of freedom to just kind of, wouldn't it be funny? It's kind of like that story that Spielberg tells about Harrison Ford and Raiders and being sick as a dog, and it was supposed to be this big fight with a whip and a sword, and the guy just goes, well, why don't we just shoot him, and everyone laughed, and he goes, oh, shoot, do that. It's almost like they go, wouldn't it be funny if Robert Ford just busted his ass, you know, doing this? Yeah, okay, just do it.
Right.
But the the movie was great, so these movies are tough to talk about sometimes because they're just so good.
I think one of the things I really liked about it and watching it reminded me of, because I remember seeing this from a young age. I've watched this a lot of times, and the Ben Kingsley character who plays the Cosmo, who eventually turns out to be the villain of the movie, is so great. And I realize, I think this was actually the first villain in a movie that I saw that had a motivation that I sympathized with. And that had that, like, it was the first villain, quote unquote, in a movie that I felt was I had conflicted feelings about.
Right.
You know, that was the first time I realized that, oh, sometimes the bad guys can be complicated. They don't have to just be like Darth Vader or whatever, obviously evil. And like the beginning, like the opening scene when Cosmo gets arrested.
Right.
Was really upsetting. I remember that being, as a kid, being very upset by that. The fact that his friend gets arrested and he gets away. And there's a great moment where he kicks the window as he's being taken away, which, again, get back to the economy. That's such a, it's such a simple choice, but it conveys, it leaves that with an impact. It adds something to it. It adds a little bit of anger or a little more anguish to that moment. That makes it resonate stronger, and but it's a very simple choice. But that is like, it's choices like that really talented filmmakers are able to
see. I struggled with Cosmo's motivation.
Really?
Yeah, because he legitimately went to get pizza, and he could have gone go get pizza. He was the one who hid the damn die. I mean, so if you haven't seen it, in the opening credit or scene. Robert Redford it's not Robert Redford, but it's supposed to be the young Robert Redford and the young Ben Kingsley are in this thing, as Matt
young
said.
Robert Redford, very well cast, too. I don't know who that was, but he did a phenomenal job.
Oh, actually, I recognized him. He's in another film. I didn't know him. I can't place him, and I haven't looked it up, but he is from another. I think you'd recognize him.
He was great. Really, very.
But if you haven't seen it at the opening scene, Robert Redford. They basically do almost like a rock, paper, scissors type of thing, but it's Ben Kingsley's character holds out two hands and he's got to pick one, and if he picks wrong, the loser goes to get pizza.
Yeah.
Well, so Robert Redford loses, so he goes to get pizza, and then the cops come and take Ben Kingsley, but you know, because Ben Kingsley shows that there's nothing in either hand. So he purposely sent him out.
Sure.
So I don't, like, him being upset that Robert Redford got away with it, it's kind of like...
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, I understand what you're saying, but I can also understand how somebody spending 12 years in prison can develop a grudge.
No.
You don't just absolutely comprehension?
No, it's not beyond. Yeah, I can definitely see it, but he's being a crybaby. He has no one to blame but himself.
Sure, but I think it was more just that because when they meet again, and they play it really well together, you can tell they're still like friends. Like and Ben Kingsley even conveys like he still cares about Marty, and he yearns for that friendship still.
Right.
And I remember as a young person, that was the main thing. Is just as a young person, I remember watching that and picking up on that, and that was like the first time that concept occurred to me that you could have villains that made you think a little more, that weren't just fulfilling their function as the villain, but that actually it could be more complex than that, I guess.
Well, I think you're probably right on that. That it's, well, you're definitely right. You can be right on about how you felt. I'm not going to argue with you about how you felt. I would say that the technology in this film was something I was worried about because, you know, it's ostensibly there's some scenes in this that are supposed to be high tech.
Yeah.
And they're supposed to be, you know, for the time, it was supposed to be, you know, almost kind of like the Net.
Like the,
The, you know, Mozart's ghost kind of thing where you're supposed to be, oh my God, what can they do type of these computers. They're everywhere. And I was worried that we were going to, like, that it wasn't going to hold up. But the nice thing about it was that, there wasn't anything in the technology that they were using that had to be suspended. Like, it was more like a documentary. Like, yeah, that's what the technology was. And you could feel what it was doing would still be scary now, even with newer technology.
Yeah.
Like, the ability to break this black box is able to break in to any encrypted system. So they show them breaking into the air traffic control or the Federal Reserve or the power grid, and then they have access to do whatever they want. Yeah. And so even though the technology that they used was very low tech, lo-fi, the repercussions of that lo-fi technology were still amped up. So it got the job done and you didn't have to worry about it as much.
They didn't get bogged down in explaining the technology too much again, which is always a wise choice, I find, unless you can really back it up to not, you know, to just, but it felt authentic and it felt like, it definitely felt, and clearly, like, you know, the actors, they convinced me that they knew what they were doing, and it was all in service of the story, and I thought that it was, and it was also, I thought the stakes of the movie were very well articulated and very, and it was just, I think really as a piece of writing, I just was really impressed by it in terms of, again, its economy, but also setting up the stakes and kind of everything. It was, I found it very easy to follow, but it also, it harkened back to a time when, like, they used to respect the audience's intelligence.
Right, that you could figure it out.
And there was patience. There was a little more patience there. You do not see movies like this anymore. I mean, the Ocean movies are the closest thing you get. And part of it I think, honestly, is, again, the post 9/11 thing. Because this movie deals with government agencies and things.
Yeah.
But... It was a time when you could do that and still make it kind of lighthearted, whereas now the stakes are so much higher that it's hard to find humor in
some of these things.
Yeah. So, like, this is the kind of movie that could only really, I think, similar to the 80s, this is like you could only do this in, like, the early mid 90s. It feels very much specific to that time period.
But I love these movies where there are not a lot of action, but a lot of tension.
Yeah.
I love watching these movies. It's movies that, there's a show, I don't think you've seen it, it's on Netflix, it's called The Diplomat, with Kerry Russell and, I forget the other guy's name, but you would know him. He's from, he was the bad Black Knight in Knight's Tale. You never saw Knight's Tale with
everybody Heath already always Ledger? Looks at me. Yeah, no, never saw it.
Really?
Never did.
Did you ever see The Holiday?
No.
Okay. Judgment written all over my voice right now. Everyone listening can hear the judgment in my voice.
You folks, he's so
anyways, angry at me. Anyways, my point though in bringing up whatever I brought up, which I've lost now. What was I talking about?
You were talking about Knight's Tale.
I'm so disrupted.
You're talking about the diplomat.
The diplomat, yes. Tension without action. Mm-hmm. It is a amazing thing, I think, to have a movie where there's little actual action, mm-hmm. like physical running things that are action,
yeah.
but the tension is way high. Yeah. And they just ramp it up. There's so mm-hmm. many. Like even I'm just thinking about the scene where Robert Redford and Sidney Poitier and the two women roles are playing Scrabble, mm-hmm. right? And then Mother and David Sarandon or whatever his name is.
And River Phoenix.
Yeah. And River Phoenix are across the way.
Yeah.
And neither of those two people are doing anything remotely that would be considered action. It is very small, very low-key movements.
Yeah.
But the tension is high.
Yes.
Love it. It's such great storytelling is really what it is. And yeah. actors who can sell it.
Yeah.
You can have a screen with no dialogue and just yes. watch those actors' faces
yes.
and everything is said
yeah.
through
that. The casting is so crucial and it really, it just makes every, it just amps up everything. Like I feel like I think the script is already really good and already really clever, but you add those actors to it and it just elevates it even more. So you're just watching. It's just like, honestly, there are moments in this movie that are just pure joy to watch. It's just like, it's just so much. It's just a fun movie. It's just a really, it goes down really easy, but it also is, it delivers everything. It's funny. There's enough dramatic, there's tension. There's just enough drama to get you involved in the characters, but not too much to be overbearing. And there's just enough action. There's, you know, I mean, I just remember watching it and like every, like the way it all comes together and like the scene when, you know, the scene when David Strathairn is driving the van in particular comes
yes.
to mind, whose character Whistler is blind. And he has to drive at one point because there's no one else able to. So he has to drive the van to rescue our main characters. And Redford is guiding him through the radio. And it's just amazing.
The climactic part of that was Robert Redford after Whistler has you know, basically run over a bunch of stuff,
yes.
right? And he seemingly looks like he's got it finally under control, as much as a blind person can have
right.
him driving a car under control.
Yes.
He's driving the car, and you think, okay, it's just a straight shot. And Robert Redford just goes, now you're going to come up to a very gentle slope, very and then gentle. The car just drops off a cliff. And it's
his, like, oh, my God, I'm driving.
Yes,
oh my God.
It is.
He plays
and then he
it
takes
so
his
well.
Hands off the wheels, puts it on his head,
yeah.
and he goes, oh, wait, I can't do that.
Yeah,
and he
I know.
Puts...
It's so great. I think it's, again, these are, they're funny conceptually, but they're character-driven moments.
Yes.
So much of it is driven by the characters, and because they are set up so well initially, one, yes, because they're cast so well, but also they're set up so well. Like,
yes.
And even, like, exposition is given away just in conversational dialogue. Like, in the beginning, when Aykroyd is like, hey, Kreese, were you still in the CIA in 76 or whenever?
Right.
Like, bam, right there, ex-CIA. Like, that
right.
kind of tells us all we need to know about him.
Yeah.
And then just like it's little character things. Like, it's yep. just a really, like, I would tell people to watch this to learn how you don't need to say a whole lot to convey a lot about a character.
Yeah.
To, you know, cement dynamics.
But you need the actors, though. Because,
yeah.
because the thing that I noticed on this is that, And it's the same thing in the Ocean films. You're absolutely right on this. Is that it's a big cast,
yeah.
and it's a cast that has the chops,
yeah.
which means that each character can't get all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Like you have limited amounts of scene that you can give to each character, so
yeah.
they got to make it count.
Yeah.
And what's amazing is that every one of these can command the scene when they're on the screen,
yeah.
and so. When you have that, it's like no one's pushing over anybody else mm-hmm. to get more time
yes.
because they don't need it. They can do everything they need to in the very limited amounts of time that they have on screen.
Yeah.
And I think it's just It's just, and it adds to what you said earlier, which is the economical nature of this film. They don't have to add superfluous things because they can get everything they need out of one little shot from each one of the characters and each one of the actors without having to go through much detail.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's, it allows the movie to be so fast paced and yet still feel like you're getting all of it. Of the information.
You feel in such good hands watching it that like it you can just sit back and enjoy the experience. Like it's because the actors are so good, their dynamic is so clear and enjoyable to watch, and even like just like the blocking of scenes, how it was I noticed was really really good and interesting, and it's just it's a tough one to talk to for an hour.
I have a a particularly character, one character that I found problematic. It's not one of the main characters, but it's is the Russian mathematician. So when he comes on the screen,
the guy in the turtleneck.
Yes. Well, I want to talk about this turtleneck because I feel like the cast, whoever did the casting, was great. Whoever did costumery was this was their first job because this guy looked. You know, he is the cliche early '90s like. I don't know what to call him. It's like this, they're trying to make, this is, you know, this is perfected by Jeff Goldblum in Jurassic Park, right? Yeah, yeah. The rock star mathematician, right? That's what they're going for.
Yeah.
And Jeff Goldblum's character, Malcolm, is every, like, you can't do it any better, right?
Yeah.
And, but this guy, he's in a white turtleneck.
Yes.
He is not particularly fit in any way. He's wearing
Donald Logue, actually, who's an actor who
he's been in many recognized things. Him. Yeah, he's
American actor. He doesn't actually. He's not actually.
And he has long hair.
Yeah,
and he's got a what looks like a white jacket, like suit on, which is not. I don't think is ironed, and that doesn't fit all that well to him.
Yeah,
and which could just be the '90s. Everything was baggy then, so I'm not. It could be just the '90s, but but. I just was like, looked at him. I'm like, this guy looks like a total corn ball.
Strange cast or costume choices there for sure. But he's you know gotten rid of pretty quickly. So it's like,
yes, that's all he has. He doesn't ever have any other lines.
Yeah, it's that's
hell.
Really,
his mistress has more.
His whole function is essentially to be killed. Like that's really.
But he didn't get killed.
He did.
Oh, he did get killed.
I think you were in the bathroom. You went. See, this is the thing.
Oh, I went to the bathroom. They had family viewing. Family viewing.
You can't do it again because you go to the bathroom too many times and you miss
family viewing. It's not the family, but the family didn't cause me.
It violates the integrity of the podcast when you miss moments.
Yeah, I forgot about that. So he did die. Okay.
Yeah. So, but yeah, there were just a lot of really good jokes in the movie too. A lot of great humor. One of my favorites is the scene when Redford is, this whole sequence actually, but it starts with him having to get into Janik's office, which has a keypad, one of those keypad code things on the door to unlock it.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, well, shit, because like, he had planned on having to pick the lock. And he's like, I don't know. And then they're like, oh, these things are impossible. How do you get through them? And Aykroyd's like, I think a buddy of mine, you know, had a...
From
Desert Storm might have a... He had a method here, and he gives it to Sidney Poitier, and Poitier is like, ugh. All right, now this might work. And then we see Redford listening, and he's going, uh-huh, uh-huh, yep, okay. All right, I'll give it a shot. And then he just kicks the door open. And I love that moment. And it's funny, too, because I was talking about this before we watched it, and you mentioned, because my interpretation of that was that it was a joke because what he did was so simple, but it took Poitier so long to explain it to him, and that was the joke, that he's sitting there so long
listening. That is the joke.
Well, but you explained something different, which is that maybe he...
I can explain...
Poitier was explaining something more complicated, and Redford just decided to just kick the
door. No, that's not what I was saying.
Well, I thought that's what you were saying.
But that is another alternative option. Yeah. I was just saying that I think what was being said there, all the wasn't like step one,
right.
Take a step back, step two, you know, it wasn't like, you know, step three, raise your leg and kick and and forcefully push forward. Like, it wasn't that. I just was saying that he could be saying, the technical details of these locks requires them to have X amount of blah 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 force, and and if you kick it with enough force, then it will short circuit this particular gadget.
Right,
and Redford's just going, and he goes, so I think if you just kick just to the right of the keypad with this much force, it'll disable the mechanism, and you'll and it'll should pop open. And he goes, okay, well, I'll give it a shot. Yeah,
that's probably
that is what I think could be said, but it is not
but the fact
it,
that you the don't. Perfect,
the it is purposefully for humor, though.
Yeah, because the fact that you don't hear what he's saying, and then what he does is so simple. It's such a great simple joke.
But
the,
sold by Redford.
Yeah, he is this
great.
Movie. Yeah, this movie really made me appreciate him more because sometimes I gotta say I take him for granted sometimes as an actor. I think because. He's so good looking and like he's very much like Clooney. I think is very much this age as Robert Redford. Like Clooney's very similar because they're both directors and both kind of very similar, very good looking guys have the movie star thing, but they essentially have one persona that they kind of play continuously.
Right,
but he is so fucking watchable. It's ridiculous. And in this movie, and also really funny. Like in this movie, his comedic timing was phenomenal.
And he has these ways of it's in his eyes. Mm. It's completely in his eyes of being able to dismiss, like to show annoyance, show frustration, show you know all of that in his eyes.
Yeah.
And this is when we talk about the economical use, the ability to say stuff without saying things, I think of Redford because there's so many times where he less adept actor would have to say words to get you to understand it, and he can just make a face or just have his eyes squint in such a way that you're like, I get where he's coming from on this.
Yeah, very. It makes total sense that him and Paul Newman, were such a good team because they're Newman's similar, like very similar. Like
right.
It was really it was like Newman, Redford, Clooney. Like they're all from this. They're all of the same kind of quality, which is they have the ability to convey a lot with not saying anything, and just have such an incredible screen presence that just it. It's like the gravity all just goes to them when they're on screen.
I feel like this movie, there's so many good parts in this movie, and you're able to just, some of the holes in it, which are inevitable in these kind of movies, you overlook because so much of it is so well done.
Yeah.
I do think the end sequence has the most problems that they could have done. They should have changed some things. They have to raise the temperature of this room to 98.6 degrees,
right?
And he has to only move at 2 inches per second,
right?
Now I don't know about you, but moving at 2 inches per second is a very physical thing to do. It is 100% control. There is no momentum whatsoever. Yeah. You cannot have momentum in 2 inches per second.
Right.
Again, my brain's not caught at the door. But at 2 inches per second, you are Tai Chi-ing your motherfucking ass across the damn, across this room.
Yes.
Right? Which is going to be physically difficult.
Yeah.
He should be drenched
exhausted,
in sweat.
Yeah.
He should be drenched in sweat.
Yeah.
He doesn't have a single bead of perspiration on his face.
Yeah.
It is the most annoying part of that. Anyone who's lived in Florida at 98.6 degrees knows that you do not stay dry at 98.6 degrees.
Yeah.
They make it sound like he is just walking for a part. You know, like it's ridiculous.
True. While I was watching it, that didn't even occur to me.
Really?
Like, it honestly didn't.
Well, you don't sweat like I do.
I sweat. Listen,
not like me.
You never loaded trucks in UPS in the summer in Florida, my friend. So
loading trucks.
You don't know anything about sweating.
Matt, I'm sweating now. Load a pillow. Hand me a pillow and watch me sweat. I don't need to load a truck. I sweat eating. I mean, why are you sweating so much, Jeff? I lifted a fork. I'm trying to just eat. Please. No, he's so that frustrated me. The second part of that ending sequence that Todd brought up, which I didn't I was gonna bring up. Yeah. But is he crawls through the ceiling?
Todd's our brother, by the way. For those,
yeah, Todd. Todd's our brother of the family viewing. He not, brought
not
it up.
That
and
anyone
think,
outside of our family listens to this?
No, they do.
Apart from Casper Van Dien and the family
and
of William Hickey.
Family of William Hickey. Is Robert Redford goes crawling through the ceiling?
Yeah.
On ceiling tiles.
Yes.
Ceiling tiles are cardboard.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yes.
And they can hold like a max weight of 20 pounds, maybe. And and it's a full human being walking, you know, basically crawling across the whole thing.
It's true.
And there's no explanation on why or whatever.
But this is also, I mean, it's in so many movies that it's kind of, you know, we just kind of, I think we just accept it at this point. Yeah. You know?
No, I don't.
Yes, you don't? Okay.
So there's that. And then, lastly, so they get caught.
Yeah.
And they're about to kill him. And then there's like multiple gunshots. She shoots the gun. So remember, they're about to get shot.
Right,
he walks
right,
off.
Yes.
River Phoenix falls through the ceiling.
Yeah.
So again, I just want to want to make sure that everyone understands what happened here.
Right.
The ceiling's strong enough to have them walk all over it. But when he decides to go through it,
quite easily,
it flies away.
Yes.
Magically. Okay. Just
yes.
It's true.
All
he has to do is think it, and it's gonna now be brittle.
Yeah.
So he goes on, and there's a gun that goes on the floor, and she gets the gun, fires it off, and then they get away.
Yeah.
Nobody hears that shit. Nobody hears the gun go off. Nobody hears this big crash. Yeah. Nobody hears anything.
Yeah.
No, the security guards aren't watching the video anymore.
Well, that's great. And it's true all those security guards did seem to disappear.
Hundreds.
There were a lot.
Hundreds
a ton
of security guards.
Yeah,
they somehow just said, okay,
well,
go home.
Well, we didn't find anything, so we're going to
go home. Yep. And they all just, not just go home, they ran.
Yeah,
they ran to their cars and sped away.
Yes.
Get out of here.
Yeah.
Old man Kingsley keeping us late again for his all of his worries.
Yeah.
So that was a little those two parts, and then the last thing, Robert River gives him the wrong box,
right,
and goes down the ladder.
Yeah.
Ben Kingsley relatively quickly realizes that the box is gone.
Yeah.
And then he just gives up.
Yeah.
He just gives up.
Yeah.
Bested. I'm just done. I can't do anything. And they go off and celebrate.
Well, yeah. I guess so. I guess this movie's terrible.
I didn't say it's terrible. I love the movie. I love it. I'm willing to overlook all of that because I think the acting is strong enough. I think if you'd watched it the first time, you may not notice those things because you're into what's going on.
Yeah.
But for me, this is like this is multiple times watching it. Again, they could have done some things that would have made that a little better.
Yeah.
They could have done some just small things that wouldn't have taken any more time or budget to make that not as bad. They didn't have to have so many guards.
It's true. I mean, but the thing about that is I tend to overlook those things because their focus was, unlike a lot of movies, their focus was more on the characters and more on and those dynamics and making that believable and interesting. And I think that's more important than some plot holes, you know? So I can forgive it when as long as I believe the people in the movie. And in this case, I believe that all of those characters were real people. Like it really felt like they were real people. And so it made seeing him in this situation, you kind of there is a suspension of belief that you, of disbelief that you can have because you believe in the people, you know.
Yeah,
and that's really important.
Well, on that topic of them being believable, I think that another interesting thing is unlike Oceans, where there's a glamour to everybody in that film, you know, everybody, even the guys who seem like who may be poor are wearing like the dirty poor stuff that looks really cool. Like everyone looks super cool.
Yeah.
These guys all look, and I think this adds to their real, like I don't think Oceans feel like real people to me.
Right.
They feel like cool interesting characters that I like to watch, but they don't feel like real people.
Yeah, I think style is more important in those
movies. Yeah. And this movie, though, I think that the reason why they look like real people is the clothes they're wearing are very just off the rack. Mm-hmm. I mean, they went to Target, which didn't exist in Macy's. They went down to Macy's and got off the rack stuff and said, here you go.
Yeah.
This is what you're wearing. I mean, Sidney Poitier's, I mean, he looks like someone who's just going to an office.
Yeah.
Redford, the same thing. Like, they don't look glamorous.
Yeah.
And I just think it's really well done. I just wish the end was a smidge better.
Yeah.
I wish they did, because the lead up to getting into there was all about it.
Right.
The way they seduced Needle Nose Ned the Head.
Oh my God, Stephen Tobolowsky, one of those.
God,
great,
that's his name.
Yes, Stephen Tobolowsky.
God, that is he looks like a Stephen Tobolowsky. Makes sense.
Yeah, just one of the great character actors. You know him. You audience members would most likely know him as Needle Nose Ned.
Ned the Head
from Groundhog Day. Ned Ryerson. Who is, you know,
Ned
one of those
Ryerson, Case Western Ned High.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, genius. Just always, whenever I see his name, and it's a hard name to miss, when I see that name in the credits, I always smile.
What other movies has he been in?
He's a ton of stuff. I mean, of course, I can't name any of them off the top of my head, but I'm going to look him up and I'm going to name them, because there's so many. He's been in so many things.
Tupperware? His last name's Tupperware?
What's his last name?
Tupperware?
Tobolowsky.
Tobolowsky.
He's in Thelma and Louise. He's in Basic Instinct.
Oh.
He was in Sneakers. He was in The Pickle. He was in Groundhog Day.
He'd be in The Pickle.
My Father the Hero.
Oh, that's a Jeffrey Depardieu, isn't it?
Yeah. He was in The Insider.
Okay.
He's in Memento. Oh, he's in Memento. He was Sammy Jenkins in Memento, the guy in like the flashbacks.
Right.
He tells the story about.
All right. Well.
Yeah. Ton of stuff.
Well, great, Ned the Head, though, great, is his classic.
He'll forever be known.
Yes. Yeah. But I think you hit the nail. I want to see a sequel of this.
I can't believe
they didn't do it.
Any movie deserved a franchise.
Like, but I think that. Why do you think that is? Do you think it would be just too difficult to get all of those guys back together?
Maybe. Well, for one, I mean, River Phoenix.
Yeah, he dies. But he didn't play a huge part in this. He could easily just be.
That made me sad, though, because he was so fucking great.
Yeah, but
it's always such a shame, because he was so good. But I mean, you know, I guess they could have done it without him, but I mean, honestly, I think the movie just wasn't very successful when it came out. I don't think it was I think it was decently received, but I don't think it was a huge box office hit. And frankly, it's a movie that people don't really talk about that much, which I think is a tragedy, because it really is. This is one of those movies.
It's a fun film.
It's another movie that I would feel comfortable recommending to just about anybody.
Yes.
Like, I feel like anybody could watch it and enjoy it.
And I feel more comfortable about it now after watching it in family viewing, because, I mean, we mentioned it to... you know, our parents and then our brother and sister-in-law, and the four of them didn't remember it. They didn't know what it was. I'm sure they saw it, because we saw it. I'm sure they saw it. They just didn't remember seeing it.
Yeah.
And they enjoyed it. Right. They were able to, you know, it's just a fun movie to watch. It's not one that it's not critically, don't go in there with Oscar thinks, you know, it's just a fun movie to watch.
Yeah. I think when it comes to like, studio movies, genre movies with like big stars, like this is what I like.
This is how
it should be done. This is it, that kind of a tone, that kind of a pacing, just the whole feeling of it. It's just a blast to watch. The cast is phenomenal. I also really liked listening to the score. I like the score a lot, and it reminded me of the time. Like, honestly, the 90s was the greatest decade of film scores I think ever. And it's something that people don't talk about too much.
Okay.
Because it was, if you go back and watch even, and we'll see it on this podcast, we'll go back, and there's a lot of movies from that era. And it didn't matter if the movie was shitty.
Right.
The score was always amazing.
Right.
And always, like, this was back, back when scores had melodies.
Yeah, So you're saying the melodies.
Yeah, because now, there's brilliant scores done now, but now it's different. Now scores... If you think about it, I really believe this is true. The majority of the scores you see in movies now are more abstract and more like experimental and it's and there's a lot of really cool stuff, like, you know, Radio Johnny Greenwood from Radiohead does scores now that are like really interesting and awesome. Trent Reznor from Nine Inch Nails, there's lots of great stuff being done, but it made me miss the time when scores were kind of like, we're following more of the John Williams school that were more about being melodic and actually having a theme.
Not to get into politics, but the reason for that is unions, is the fall of unions.
Why is that?
Because back in the day, in old studio terms, the unions would, I think it's the Screen Actor Guild, and there was another one, there was a Music Guild. Yeah. When they would negotiate their contracts, they would negotiate that the films had to have orchestral scores. And so the studios had to keep on staff musicians to do the music. And the same thing with television. They would have, that's why if you listen to like all of the stuff from the old time, it has all this great orchestral music or jazz music and stuff like that. Famously, John Williams, that's how John Williams got his start. He was a pianist for in the union, and then he started doing scores through that. And so when they got into the union negotiations with the studios, those things went away.
All right.
And they stopped requiring those. Yeah. And then all these musicians, you didn't have all these jobs for musicians, and it started to go off, you know, off set, I guess, or off
out of
lot.
Just out of the studio system.
They don't handle it, and that's why, you know, and then it kind of goes away. But yeah, it was...
Well, it's understandable. Like, and like I said, I think it went in a very interesting direction. I mean, some of my favorite film scores aren't necessarily, you know, are a little more abstract and complex, and I think are really, really cool. But it made me nostalgic for the time when I knew, when as a kid, when we go to the movies and see these movies in the theater, and they always had these great big melodic scores that always had these great themes that would get stuck in your head. And even something like just thinking like Waterworld, when we get to that, like the score for that was awesome. And like just like all these movies, that these studio movies, really, like the it elevated them, you know, a little bit, and it made them, it just added something to it. Maybe it's just nostalgia, or like a romantic sort of nostalgia for it, but it made me miss that time when scores were like, when scores were hummable, you know, when they had something that
you could
come out of the theater humming the tune from the score, you know. You don't have that anymore. That doesn't happen.
No, you do not have anything close to that.
Yeah.
So I am looking at, what is this, the American Federation of Musicians. Mm. And it says, most film and TV work is covered by the American Federation of Musicians Basic Theatrical Motion Picture and TV Film Agreements. And in that, this is from 2020, scoring in the United States or Canada, page 2. I'm sure people are just loving this as I'm reading a 190-page union agreement.
this is our new segment of the podcast where you break down
union contracts.
Yeah, you break down union contracts. It's really fascinating.
Yeah, so see, what happened was in this contract, it is showing that like you have to use musicians within the United States and Canada to, if you're going to score it with musicians, you have to score it with the United States and Canada musicians. Gotcha. It used to say that you had to use orchestral stuff.
Right, okay.
And that's why if you look in the, I don't think it was, it's like this is 40s, 50s, like 30, 40s, 50s time, not 80s, 70s, but like way back when, and that's where a lot of those musicians came out of.
Right,
is all of that. I think what's his name came out of that too. I thought somebody big came out of it, other than John. I'm pretty sure John Williams came out of that system. You can cut all this.
Well, I'm reading the Wikipedia, and it's actually nice to see that apparently making the movie was a wonderful experience for everyone. Which is always nice to hear. And the director said that the only way it could have been better would have been if the lab lost the films, they would have to do it all over again. That's nice to hear. You like to hear that people had a good time on these pictures, especially when they turn out so good.
You don't want to see a movie you love and say everyone hated it.
Yeah, so apparently they all... And if you can feel that when you watch it, you can feel that they all really like working together.
Well, because a lot of the scenes are just in one room.
Right.
You know, like they don't. It's not. Again, it's not a. It, like I think the movie's great. I think we've gushed over it a little bit too much. What is Roger's? Do we have Roger's thoughts on this?
We do, and this is Roger's throwing me for a loop lately. This is like with all four of these. I mean, except for Robin Hood, which he was on the right. He was on the same page. I have not read his review but I'm looking at the star rating, and Roger Ebert gave Sneakers 2.5 stars.
Okay.
Which I know, not okay. I don't think that's okay. I think to give this anything less than 3 stars is wrong. I think this movie is a solid 3-star movie. All right.
I'm not upset with the 2.5 stars.
Well, I am.
Okay.
This is what he says. Okay. The computer stuff in Sneakers has been widely touted. The studio even released a press kit on discs. Ooh.
Wow. On discs.
The future. But it's underwhelming in the movie. The big display of the secret program consists of a screen full of alphabet soup, which then unscrambles itself into a decoded message. The software to achieve this would be awesome, but the screen display is no big deal, and indeed one of the weaknesses of the movie is the way it pretends to be a techno thriller, when in fact it recycles much older traditions. Take Redford's team, which is yet another version of the World War II platoon that always had one of everything. This time there is the black guy, Sidney Poitier, the fat guy, Dan Aykroyd, the blind guy, David Strathairn, the woman, Mary McDonnell, and the kid, River Phoenix. Wow. There is not enough useful dialogue to go around for such a large team, and sometimes characters feel like they've been pushed on stage for obligatory scenes that are not really necessary. Then look at the bad guy. Kingsley plays the role for all it's worth with a nice oily smarminess, but come on. Does a techno caper need to end with violence and stunts like standard action movies? And when we see shots of vans roaring up to discharge armed agents who surround a factory, is it too much to ask what happened to them when they disappear in the next exterior scene?
Yes.
Okay, he's got a point there. I also had real big problems with a key scene in which a guy drops through the ceiling to blindside a villain about to shoot one of the good guys. This moment manages to combine the two entries from my glossary of durable cliches, the talking killer syndrome and the fallacy of the predictable tree. Okay. The talking killer is the bad guy who has the drop on the hero and need only to shoot him dead, yet hesitates and keeps blabbing long enough for something to save the day. The predictable tree is named after the first Rambo movie, in which the bad lawman paused under a tree and Rambo dropped on him. Why did the lawman choose that tree? How did Rambo know he would? In Sneakers, a bad guy stands directly beneath the place in the ceiling where one of Redford's teammates is concealed. What a coincidence. There are good qualities to the movie. The break-ins are directed with skill and imagination by Phil Alden Robinson, Field of Dreams, and his screenplay gives the characters some interesting things to say. Dan Aykroyd is funny as the conspiracy nut who knows the story behind everything. It's a sometimes entertaining movie, but thin. And that's the end.
I just don't think it needs to be fuller.
Yeah,
Mr.
Yeah,
Ebert.
Yeah,
I don't think. I think where you're searching for things where you don't need to be searching for them.
Yeah,
it's.
This is a studio. It's a studio genre caper movie with a great cast. I don't think there was nothing missing from the movie.
Yeah, what did he need? What's interesting is he says there was not enough dialogue. We just spent 20 minutes talking about how you didn't need the dialogue.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what he wanted more.
Yeah, I don't know. I think honestly, I think Roger was kind of cynical in the 90s.
I'm getting the feeling too.
I really think he was. I think he was a little. I think maybe coming off the 80s into the 90s, you know, after the 70s, I think maybe, because he's very much of that, again, of that era, the 70s movie brat, you know, era. I think he could be very cynical about, like, studio movies, I think, and something like this, I guess. I mean, yeah, but I don't know what he expected, because this is the kind of movie, I think it's a really solid movie that I would feel comfortable recommending to anybody. Like, I can't see how you watch it and not have a good time. It doesn't make sense to me.
It's a good movie.
I think your brain...
You laugh.
You don't enjoy it.
You laugh. You gasp.
Yeah.
There's tension.
It's not meant to. It's just super entertaining and enjoyable.
It is a popcorn movie.
Yes,
in my view, it's like you sit there, eat some popcorn, enjoy a flick, and go home, not worrying about whether or not you learned anything from it. It's just a good movie.
Yeah.
All right, I say two nuns up
for sure.
Two nuns up. No nuns, but two nuns up.
Yeah, but if you haven't seen it, again, highly recommend. because this is one of those that I feel like a lot of people probably haven't seen, which is a shame, and more people should. I think it is one of the more underrated movies of the 90s.
I think it's probably gone up over the years. I think I think if people watched it now, they'd find it more entertaining.
I will say to kind of go back to how we were talking about the post-9/11 or pre-9/11 thing. Funnily enough, I do think like a lot of the stuff about information and kind of a lot of the stuff that Ben Kingsley's character was talking about was like, well, yeah, this shit is actually all very relevant today.
Well, that's what I was trying to get at is that the reason why I think it's more the tension ratchets up more now because like. I would imagine in the 90s, the idea of someone cracking the code and being able to do this, while scary, felt unrealistic,
right.
Futuristic. Like, that's not happening.
Right.
Watching it now, then I'm like, yeah. And then knowing what would happen if someone had the opportunity to get access to it.
Yeah.
So the tension goes through the roof. For you now, mostly because of the post 9/11 thing, where it's like
the stakes weren't as high then.
You could laugh at a million people dying,
right?
Yeah, as we've talked about in Independence Day, you know, you could blow up a million people and make a joke about it, and people go, "Yeah, that's funny."
Yeah, in a way, and yeah, it actually feels a little more, a little more like alarming,
real.
And real today, So yeah, I think it actually probably not only does it hold up, it's probably actually. Maybe even a little better unintentionally than it was in the 90s because the stakes in the world are
life
higher.
Life has shifted to make this movie a little more realistic.
Yes. So yeah, definitely watch it if you haven't. Highly recommend.
All right. Well, that's Sneakers.
Yeah.
I don't know what our next one's going to be.
I don't either.
Do you have a list?
I don't have my list. I need to have one that I can just access easily.
Okay.
But I guess we'll. We'll select something and then.
Well, I'd like to do.
You want
to
pick? I want you to pick a movie.
You want me to pick a movie?
Because I feel like I am always picking them, and I'm fine with that because I have a lot of options.
Okay.
But I want you to.
What movie should I pick? From our childhood that we should watch. Okay, here's one. The Mask. Jim Carrey's The Mask.
Okay.
I haven't seen that movie in a really long time.
Good choice. I love it. I'm just honestly, I'm just psyched to do a Jim Carrey movie.
Yeah,
we haven't yet.
Yeah, I'm
and
I'm thinking The Mask. We got Jim Carrey. We got Cameron Diaz as the first like.
Hey, you don't. I have watched this movie so many.
Okay,
times.
I have not seen this movie in probably 25 years.
Great. I'm really interested to hear your thoughts on that one.
Yeah, I'm interested to see how I go. This is
Jim Carrey easily. I would put him second only to Robin Williams as, for me at least, the most important comedic actor of my childhood.
Really?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Over second to Robin Williams.
Yeah, it'd be Robin Williams number one always. But
yeah,
Jim Carrey
was.
Sure.
I mean, we were.
I mean, I was a little younger than you, so I think you were. You maybe. I think you were just. But like, I was like, okay. So in 1994, Jim Carrey released Ace Ventura, the first Ace Ventura, The Mask, and Dumb and Dumber, all in the same year.
Wow.
He became
in the
span of a year. He became literally like the biggest star in the world, and. I was like 9 years old that year. So I was like, my friends and I were his perfect demographic. So I seriously cannot tell you how many times we watched those movies on VHS, like over and over and over again. Like I know every single word to all of those early movies of his. And he is he's one of my just all time. God damn it. I love him so much.
All right. Let's do The Mask. I haven't seen that
good
one
choice.
In a long
time. Okay.
I've seen, I feel like I've seen Liar Liar. Enough. More. Ace Ventura, I haven't seen Ace Ventura in a long time too. But
and, I mean, Dumb and Dumber is like a legit classic.
And Dumb and Dumber is Dumb and Dumber.
For real.
I mean,
we'll
get to it,
but yeah, that's
it's. There's nothing. The reason why I'm bringing The Mask is because I'm curious. Yeah. I'm curious how it holds up.
I'm interested to see how you think. I know how I feel about it, but I'm interested to see how you feel.
Okay.
About
it. All right. Maybe well, we'll do The Mask.
All right. The Mask sounds good.
All right. So Matt, take us.
Love it.
Away.
You know, just, you know, take care of yourselves out there, folks. You know, it's a rough world. We're all just, I don't know why the fuck I'm trying to give you people advice. I don't know what I'm doing. Like, what am I? Bye. I'll see you next time.